Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today are political analysts Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Nice to have you back with us, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Sarah Mitchell is with us as well from the University of Iowa, where she is the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
We'd want to make sure that you join us this hour if you'd like to pitch in a question or a comment. Later in the hour, that FBI search of Mar-a-Lago that's creating so much controversy. Also, takeaways from yesterday's primaries. We'll ask Sarah and Dennis about their takeaways, including primaries in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Before that, let's start with what has been called the Inflation Reduction Act by the Democrats. However, one article suggested a better three-word summary than that would be climate, medicine, and taxes, a bill that focuses on lowering health care costs, promoting clean energy, increasing corporate taxes. It passed the U.S. Senate on Sunday, is expected to pass the House of Representatives as soon as Friday of this week, then will be sent to President Biden's desk. Unless something unforeseen happens, it looks like clear sailing for that bill to become law. It represents the most significant climate investment in U.S. history, and along with the Affordable Care Act, is being touted as the most ambitious piece of legislation signed by a Democratic president in more than half a century. That's a huge claim. We'll get Sarah and Dennis's comment on that. But first of all, let's listen to some comments from those on Capitol Hill. Overall, the bill, of course, very scaled down to what many Democrats, including President Biden, had asked for originally. Here's the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking to Judy Woodruff yesterday on PBS's NewsHour. Woodruff asked Schumer about the months of wrangling and why Democrats couldn't agree sooner.
Well, no one was ready to do it sooner. The bottom line is that we wanted to get as good a package as we could. Senator Manchin rejected even the $1.85 billion package with President Biden. And so I sat down with him and we negotiated. It took us a while to get there. But just everybody, including the most progressive people, you looked at every senator from Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin voted for this. Everyone thought this was a lot better than nothing. The choice was not this or something better, because Manchin Sinema wouldn't have voted for anything beyond this as much as I would have liked to go. The choice was this or nothing, and this is very significant. The most significant reduction in carbon into the atmosphere ever, by legions more than we have ever done. Finally dealing with prescription drugs, finally dealing with those loopholes that the wealthy get away with. This is very, very significant legislation. Now, it's easy to say, well, you should have done more. You should have done it differently. This is a really good package we're proud of. And the American people, by all polling data, 70, 80% support it. Even 40% of Republicans support it.
Okay, the sole Democrat, Cindy Axne, in Iowa's congressional delegation, is alone in her support for the bill. Of course, that House vote coming up later this week, we're expecting. Both of Iowa's senators voted against the bill on Sunday. Senator Ernst called it reckless at a time of high inflation. In a tweet, Senator Grassley had this to say in a statement Sunday: families across America are suffering from 40-year inflation, 40-year high inflation fueled by a partisan anti-energy, anti-growth, anti-tax or tax and spend agenda. This partisan bill written behind closed doors without any input from Republicans will raise taxes, cut jobs, kill cures, and fuel inflation, all at the worst possible time. The American people have endured enough. That's what Grassley had to say Sunday. Republican Representative Ashley Hinson and fellow U.S. representatives expected to vote against the bill this week. Here's what Representative Hinson had to say on the bill on Newsmax last week.
Yeah, well, Iowans can see right through President Biden and Speaker Pelosi's lies about this bill. The title is completely misleading. It does not reduce inflation. In fact, through 2024, it'll actually drive it upwards. I think we all learned our lesson when the Democrats last year were touting their $1.9 trillion spending bill, saying it was going to help the American economy, when instead Republicans were raising alarms that it would contribute to inflation. And that's exactly what we've seen. So raising taxes and spending more money during a recession is not a good idea. In fact, it just places more of a burden on Iowa working families and American working families. And that's exactly what this bill does. It targets them. It supercharges the IRS. It targets our manufacturers and our small businesses with higher taxes. I don't know what kind of rock the White House is living under or Speaker Pelosi is living under, but I can tell you the stories that I hear from my constituents, and inflation is hurting them. That pinch at the pump, the pinch at the grocery store, they feel it every single day, and that's why they're going to come out and turn out in record numbers and vote for Republicans in November.
Iowa Congresswoman Ashley Hinson, River to River listeners, what's your reaction to this sweeping legislation? Legislation targeting health care, climate, and tax policy. Too much spending? Not enough? What do you agree with that you just heard? What do you disagree with? What are your questions about the politics attached to it? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You could also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Sarah and Dennis, a big windup there, but this is a big deal. Dennis, let's start with you. How big of an accomplishment is this for the Democrats?
Well, you know, with the Senate divided exactly evenly, 50-50, that gives any senator veto power over anything that might occur. And as we've seen, Senator Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Sinema of Arizona have, in effect, exercises that figurative veto power, so to speak. If they don't like something, they say they won't vote for it, and there's nothing the Democrats can do. So I think what the what the Biden administration and the Democrats want to do is, in this particular case, is tout the fact that, in their view, they have a legislative accomplishment. Now, the merits of it, how successful will it be? You heard Representative Hinson in that piece of audio giving a very strongly worded, although typically kind of rhetorical argument against any kind of spending that you hear from Republicans normally, whereas Democrats always want to talk about spending, but they never say spending, they say investment. So look at one of the earlier drafts of this from the Democrats. They refer to the amount of money they're spending on energy security and climate change as an investment, and they talk about the extension of the Affordable Care Act as an investment. So they don't want to say spending, but no, this is a bill that raises revenue by a certain amount, raises spending by a lesser amount. And the difference is what the Biden administration wants to say is applied toward deficit reduction. So they want to be able to say they have a legislative accomplishment that, on the one hand, makes people's lives better, in their view. On the other hand, does something to decrease government spending.
Mm-hmm. Reaction from Governor Reynolds on this. Inflation is at a 40-year high, and a tweet from her. Yet the Democrats' solution, pass another reckless tax and spending spree of $740 billion. This will affect all Americans who are already struggling to make ends meet. Join our conversation. What is your view? 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Sarah, before your response, just the three sort of chair legs of this big bill tackling climate change, more than $300 billion to be invested in energy climate reform, the largest federal clean energy investment in U.S. history, prescription drugs. They're making prescription drugs more affordable. There are some limits there. You have to go into a lot of details to understand that. Tax reform, legislation creating a 15% minimum tax for corporations making a billion or more in income. That brings in more than $300 billion in revenue. Sarah, what's your overall impression of the accomplishment for the Democrats here?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most significant bills ever passed by the party, certainly on the front of the environment. This is going to provide tax incentives for lots of improvements toward clean energy and moving past fossil fuel dependence. And so, for example, you'll be able to get credit for up to 30% of the costs of, putting solar panels on your house, installing a small wind energy system, a heat pump. If you want to buy an electric vehicle, you could get a tax credit of up to $7,500, although there's some limits in the bill in terms of that a portion of the minerals in those vehicles' batteries would have to be extracted or refined from countries with that trade in free trade agreements with the U.S. So there are some limitations there, but I think and then also, you know, a huge amount of tax credits for businesses to expand for energy efficiency in commercial buildings. So this is going to provide the tax incentives that will really move the United States toward what the Europeans already have, which is, you know, a very widespread clean energy approach. And the analyses that have been done on that have shown that this is going to, you know, reduce our carbon emissions by as much as 40% by 2030. And so if you're looking around what's happening this summer, right, there have been massive heat waves, lots of, you know, really devastating storms. And we know from the literature on climate change that those trends are going to continue. And so I would say the environmental side of this bill is probably the most significant thing to be passed.
Right. And Sarah, just to follow up, the climate change we've been talking about on this program for more than 10 years, seriously, many times a year, not a lot of resonance in some case until recent years. So are the Democrats, do you think, catching a wave, to use sort of a surfing analogy, that awareness has been raised enough to make this near or at the top of the list for voters?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in political science research that the more people personally experience disasters and storms and things like that, heat waves, they're more supportive of taking action, right, to reduce carbon emissions. And so I think because we've seen such a much, you know, the U.S. has always been one of the largest disaster experiencing countries in the world, but I think, you know, the geographical spread, you know, so many people are experiencing these disasters, and so I think the Democrats are capitalizing on the support for making a big shift in the way that we're treating energy policies in this country.
Political scientist Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. It's a Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation later this hour. We'll, of course, talk about that FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. But right now we're on what is called the Inflation Reduction Act. Dennis, comment on this name, because this is such a reflection of our politics. Democrats have argued the measure will tackle voters' main economic concern. They named it the Inflation Reduction Act. Republicans arguing the new spending will aggravate inflation. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office says, though, the bill has a, quote, negligible effect on inflation in 2022 into 2023. This is just how we have to name bills to get them through, Dennis?
Well, it's the politics of naming. That's important in all sorts of ways. Political rhetoric, we use the term rhetoric sometimes in a dismissive manner, but rhetoric matters in terms of how you frame something, just as when we get to the issue of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago, the rhetorical aspect of there is very strongly in play. So here, yes, everybody's concerned, not so much right now about joblessness. Unemployment rates are extremely low, although there are fewer people in the workforce, evidently. But you've got all these places. I mean, I can't imagine how many pools seem to be closing, at least here in central Iowa, this early in August, because they can't get staff at this point. So unemployment is not so much of an issue, which would be one aspect if we were in a recession, and it's disputed as to whether we were or not. But, you know, when I would go with my compact SUV and fill my tank a month ago and it cost me $50, that's inflation. That hurt. And that's where people feel it very much. Now, we're very lucky here in Iowa, although we usually have higher gasoline prices because of taxes than, say, Missouri does. Still, I just filled my tank this morning with, super unleaded for $3.339. Now, that's about a half dollar more than gasoline was a year ago, I believe, but it's still about $1.50 to $1.60 less than gasoline was at the beginning of the summer. But that's where people feel it. Or go look at a restaurant price list now and what they have to do to try to make ends meet. So people are feeling the inflation very personally, and that's what matters to them, what affects them personally. So this is an attempt by the Biden administration, whatever the substance of the policy, to rhetorically try to claim the high ground.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. Suzanne is with us from Grinnell. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the program. What's your question or comment?
Oh, hi. Thank you. Yes. Well, I believe that this legislation does have a tax on those buybacks, those shareholder buybacks. And we've just seen in the press about how, speaking of gas, that the oil companies are raking in huge profits and they are buying, in fact, having buybacks, and that there is a minimum corporate tax in this legislation. And I think that I think EPI and the Economic Policy Institute calculated that 53% of the inflationary pressure is coming from corporate power and only 8% is coming from wages. And so I think that this is addressing the inflation because it is addressing the source point. I would like to see more taxation, but I think given Manchin and Sinema, this was as much as they could do.
Yeah. All right, Suzanne and Grinnell, thank you for your input. Yeah, we had that last-minute sort of maneuvering in the Senate to get Manchin and Sinema on board. The portion that got cut, one of the narrowest, it narrowed the carried interest tax loophole. The Arizona Republican or Democrat Kyrsten Sinema agreed to sign the bill if this measure, which would have changed the way private equity income is taxed, was cut. That would have created, brought in billions of revenue. But instead, as I understand it, a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks, I think Suzanne referred to that, was introduced. And that would bring in more revenue. It's terribly complicated stuff as we gather here, Sarah. But did you have a comment on what Suzanne brought up? I mean, we're not tax policy economists. We're talking politics today. But perhaps you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I think, you know, the 15% minimum tax on corporations that make more than $1 billion in profits is a huge win. And this is something that all of the major Democratic candidates were campaigning on, that we need to have higher taxation on the wealthiest corporations. I think the carried interest tax, basically hedge fund managers would have their profits taxed at 37% instead of 20%. So mm-hmm. that is a big loss of revenue and, you know, not sure how much money Sinema's getting from hedge funds, but obviously a lot to negotiate that out. But I think I wanted to say on inflation, first of all, that the data that just came out for July is showing that there was no increase in inflation in July. So in other words, if you look at the prices of goods, it's net zero, and essentially some prices of goods are going down, some are going up, but the net is zero. And I've seen that tracking with other inflation data that economists have been posting recently. So mm-hmm. so there is a trend downward in inflation. And we have to remember that this is not just a function of U.S. government spending, right? The war, the Russia-Ukraine war, the pandemic, which affected supply chains, these are all things that have increased inflation globally. And so you have European countries also experiencing very high rates of inflation. And so it's not just a U.S. phenomena, it's a global phenomena. And the Biden administration has taken various steps to address the supply chain issues, right? Increasing funding to the ports so that we can get those ships coming in process more quickly, things like that. So.
Right. It is a global phenomenon. Go to Europe, talk to a European about what they're paying for gas these days. They would jump for joy to be paying the gas prices we had a month ago when they were over $5 in some cases. Rachel from Cedar Rapids listening writes this in an email. Representatives who oppose the bill often say that it's going to raise taxes for everyday Americans. I find this incredibly misleading, she writes, and what they're just, they're, and what they're just trying to do is protect the wealthy Americans from paying their fair share of taxes. This bill does a great job of closing loopholes that people have been complaining about for years. It's time for corporations and the wealthy people of this country to pay their share. Rachel from Cedar Rapids. Dennis, on the taxing thing, I think there's billions, tens of billions here in funding more to the IRS so that it can catch those evading paying their taxes.
The IRS, to my knowledge, has been tremendously understaffed for quite a number of years. I have a vague memory of seeing something, a figure like something like maybe 1% of returns get audited. Not that I or anybody else is looking for an audited tax return. But, you got to spend money to make money, so to speak. People will say that in business, and in terms of the government, you got to say the same thing. If you want to make sure everybody carries his or her fair share of taxes, you've got to have people enforcing that to make sure that, in fact, occurs. So, yes, that the money spent on IRS tax enforcement in this bill is an attempt to make sure that whether one agrees or disagrees with the rates and the policies set by the government, that until they're changed, at least, those policies are followed. That's what they're trying to do there.
Mm-hmm. In the final minute or two before the break, Sarah, I wonder if you could address the lowering of the cost of prescription drugs. This is a historic measure included in the bill that allows the federal health secretary to negotiate prices of certain expensive drugs each year for Medicare. Now it's going to affect only a certain number of prescription drugs to begin with. It won't take effect quickly. I think we're looking for several years before it even has any impact, right?
Yeah, definitely. And this would allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs was in the original Affordable Care Act bill, but the GOP basically had that stripped out in negotiations. And so this is bringing in something that was part of the ACA, back into a bill, which is good. And it also ensures that recipients will pay a maximum of $2,000 in out-of-pocket costs for prescriptions annually. So it'll put a cap on those out-of-pocket costs. I think the one a lot of people were talking about was that the GOP voted out the amendment on the pay maximum for insulin at $35. And so that's unfortunate. We have over 230,000 Iowans who use insulin. And so that's something I think that is unfortunate that it was removed through the amendment process. I think also the negotiations took out a lot of things that Democrats have campaigned on, things like, federal paid family and medical leave for parents, universal pre-K, subsidized childcare. So these are all things that were in the Build Back Better, but were removed from this version of the bill.
Right. Maybe a better name for it would have been Son of Build Back Better or Daughter of Build Back Better. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Stay with us, please. We're going to go to a break and come back, talk a little bit more about this historic legislation, which looks due to be signed in the near future, after the House passes it. That's expected later this week. When we come back, we'll also talk about that search by the FBI of Mar-a-Lago. I know you have something to say about that. River to River listeners, give us your questions, your opinions. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
We're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My guests, political analysts Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, joining our conversation 1-866-780-9100. I do want to finish up our talk. The whole first half hour, this is such a big new law, soon to be law, unless something unforeseen happens. Will pass the House, predicted to on Friday, I think, and then be signed by the president. You'll hear about that. He'll be touting this for a long time, the Inflation Reduction Act. One article I read said, the three words maybe should be climate, medicine, taxes, to be more accurate. Let's go back to our callers before we move on. Talk with Grant in Cedar Rapids. I'm going to ask all our callers, because we want to accomplish quite a bit this half hour, to please get right to the nugget of what you want to say. Grant in Cedar Rapids, welcome.
Hi, Ben.
Hi.
I appreciate your show, and I appreciate the routine guests that you have on. Here's the essence of my, it's really more of a comment. I think all of our politicians grossly misrepresent the driving factors to inflation and gas prices. In this post-pandemic era, we had a huge drop-off of demand. Therefore, production globally dropped off in all categories. And then all of a sudden, post-pandemic, or what we consider post-pandemic, demand shot up and production couldn't keep up. Hence, we have higher prices. This isn't a political issue. It is fundamental supply and demand economics. And that was my comment, and I'd welcome your guest comments on that.
Okay, Grant, thank you very much in Cedar Rapids. But Dennis, take this, because we all know, if you have on one hand, you have what is the economic reality in this case of any certain economic situation, and then you have the politics. They may overlap a lot, a little, or not at all, right?
Well, again, I'm not an economist, and I don't play one on the radio, but I will say that supply and demand have to adjust to each other, all things, everything else being equal, and that can take some time. I mean, I think a lot of it is the same sort of idea seems, at least to me, to be behind the kind of mess and difficulty that's presented by air travel right now. Because with the pandemic, the airlines furloughed pilots, a lot of pilots retired, flight attendants, and so forth, and demand has shot way up, and they were sort of caught unawares in their supply side, if you will, their production, so to speak, their ability to create flights and staff flights hasn't caught up yet with the explosive demand. That you shouldn't say explosive with regard to airplanes, but you see my point. And so to the extent that oil producers did cut back somewhat, and I've just not seen data on that, so I'll take Grant's claim as valid as it stands, then, with the increased driving and everything else now, sure, that's going to put pressure on prices, and therefore they've not declined as much as we might want.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up this conversation by talking about, some headlines that I've been reading. Biden is on a roll. Is this a turning point? Joe Biden just had the best week of his presidency. Wait, is Biden a better president than people thought? So here he is, Sarah, emerging from medical isolation. Suddenly the administration an administration that we had been talking about for months, not being able to get anything right, could not catch a break, seems to be on a roll. We've had major things happen, the approval of a treaty admitting Finland and Sweden to NATO. We had that major legislation investing in the domestic semiconductor industry, and then signed just today, expanding medical care to military veterans exposed to those toxic burn pits. But at the same time, Sarah, Biden, one of the most unpopular presidents in modern history at this point in his term, according to polls. I'll ask you and Dennis, starting with you, Sarah, is this a potential turning point?
Yeah, I just saw some Rasmussen data this morning, and it showed that their latest polls have him, I think it was 8 points up. So
8 points up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if those trends continue, I mean, he should get a boost from this. I mean,
yeah.
This taken together, this set of bills, like I said, it's one of the, you could think of it as a sort of New Deal, scale in terms of how it's going to affect everyday Americans. So,
yeah.
So I think this should translate into increased approval.
Yeah. Dennis, of course, conventional wisdom and history says the party holding the White House experiences a bloodbath in Congress. What do you think? A turning point? Could they... this administration defy the historical bloodbath that the party in power experiences in midterms?
Well, bloodbath is the occasional thing that occurs, like 1994 or 2010. But yeah, the party of the president normally incurs losses during a midterm because you need somebody to blame for your dissatisfactions, and the president of the other party is always an easy target. But this particular program, let's assume it's successful, at least it's been passed or will be passed by the end of this week, isn't going to gain Biden one more Republican vote. Where it may have the better impact for him is to re-enthuse what's been demoralized Democrats so far. And we know that particularly in midterms, Democrats don't turn out to the same extent that Republicans do. So Democrats have been very demoralized. With this passage, the best thing I think Biden can hope for at this point is to re-energize those folks and make them more likely to turn out to support him and fellow Democrats in November.
Let's move on to a place called Mar-a-Lago, which is quite warm at this time of the year, I think compared to Iowa for sure. The FBI searched Donald Trump's home for possible White House records. A lot of chat about this on social media all across the country. Officials suspect the former president or his advisors kept some documents there in Florida instead of returning them with other documents, some classified earlier this year. We don't know what the FBI agents found. They took some 12 boxes after their search on Monday. This is according to Donald Trump's lawyer. Other things, so many things popping in this corner. It's hard to keep track of them. Part of a separate investigation. Donald Trump questioned by the New York Attorney General, pleading the fifth today. Also a representative, Scott Perry, he's a Pennsylvania Republican who pushed to overturn Trump's loss, said the FBI had seized his phone. Join our conversation on this point, 1-866-780-9100. Dennis, to you first. I suppose we could see, you know, we don't know what the FBI did here, what they took. It could be a debate about, you know, just what should be part of the National Archives. Or Dennis, the sign of a major new legal problem for Donald Trump?
Well, Donald Trump appears both in public affairs and in private affairs to always have a trail of or a train of lawsuits behind him, and he's always trying to maneuver around them. No, we don't know in particular what this is about. I know I was curious because the word raid was tossed around very casually. I looked it up, and technically this was a search with a warrant. A raid in most definitions it would be a situation in which law enforcement breaks in somewhere using force and surprising the target. Whereas, according to the reports I've had, the FBI agents were met at the door by the former president's Secret Service detachment, those still in Mar-a-Lago while he was at Bedminster in New Jersey, and they let them in and so forth. So it was a search with a warrant. Now, it's unprecedented, to be sure. But this is an unprecedented precedent in terms of willingness to abide by not just the laws in place, but by norms that we normally associate with presidents in the past. It's worth noting, for example, that he signed a law in 2018 that significantly increased the penalty for the unauthorized removal and retention of classified documents. So he, if this, depending upon what's in this search, and he could release the warrant and tell people, let people know what was in it, but for political reasons he's not doing it so far, it would be in violation, or at least it would fall under a law that he himself signed mm-hmm. 4 years ago in 2018. But the bottom line, I think, is this. If I'm the CEO of Coca-Cola, when I resign, I can't take the secret formula with me. That stays with the company locked up somewhere. And if these documents had to do with national security or top secret or whatever, even if you allow for the fact that the federal government oftentimes classifies too many things as top secret, still, there's a real issue here. We have to wait to see what it's about.
Okay, before we go to you, Sarah, let's listen to a couple of voices here. Former President Donald Trump released a statement saying that the search was an effort to stop his 2024 presidential run. Other Republicans said this was the Biden administration using the FBI FBI to persecute political opponents. Senator Ernst echoed these sentiments when speaking here in Iowa with KCCI.
A lot of Americans are very upset at our Department of Justice, and they are losing faith and confidence in our Justice Department because they see that perhaps it's being weaponized and used as a political tool.
Now, Democrats, like our sole congressional member, Cindy Axne, are choosing not to make statements on this search until more information is released. But here's former U.S. Senator Doug Jones of Alabama, a Democrat. He discussed the FBI probe with the PBS NewsHour yesterday and had this to say.
I'd love to hear an explanation. I'd like to see one. But I also think the public does not want to see any consequential investigation like this jeopardized. And the Justice Department's going to have to make another very serious decision as to whether or not the making public of the affidavit would, in fact, compromise the investigation going forward. And I trust them to make the right call.
Okay. Sarah, react here. Does it appear to you that the Department of Justice is making decisions consistent with the rule of law rather than driven by politics based on what we know now?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just going back to the history, Congress passed the Presidential Records Act in 1978, and that requires presidents to preserve records during their time in office. They have to consult archivists from the National Archives before they destroy any documents, and then they have to transfer documents to those archivists when they leave office. And so, and all of that was in response to Nixon when he resigned in 74. You know, he essentially tried to destroy his records, including the Watergate tapes. And so, so that presidential act came out of an era where a unlawful president tried to destroy records. And so, you know, this is obviously relevant for the Trump administration because President Trump himself, you know, routinely tore up briefings and schedules, articles and letters, memos. A lot of the documents that the January 6th committee received had been ripped up and taped back together, right?
So they're some of them flushed, and now we have photographic evidence, I think, of that.
and so, you know, Trump and his aides were warned about their violations of the Presidential Records Act early on in his administration, but they continued to destroy documents. And so what's happened since he left office is that he took boxes of documents that he was not supposed to remove, you know, to his residence in Mar-a-Lago. And so since then, the National Archives has been in negotiations with Trump and his lawyers. And so earlier in January and February, right, they removed at least 15 boxes of documents, but they found documents in there that were marked top secret. And so these are documents that a very, very small number of people in the government are approved to see. And so even among the archivists, there's only a few people with that clearance to even handle those documents. And so, and again, you know, there was a negotiation following that to get the what was still remaining there to be turned over. And so, you know, there was essentially a series of steps that's been going back and forth. And so in that regard, if this is about those records, you know, the search warrant is not that surprising because it follows, you know, a series of back and forth steps that have been taken by the Department of Justice.
Here's a tweet from U.S. Senator Charles Grassley. Transparency brings accountability. And if the FBI and DOJ aren't transparent about raiding a former president's home, they risk further damaging their credibility. I've already raised issues from whistleblowers about political bias in investigations, so we've got a right to be skeptical. Dennis, comment on Chuck Grassley's comment here, because, I mean, the DOJ probably is not going to, you know, publicize this warrant. That would be against their practice. But Donald, is there anything preventing Donald Trump from, you know, publicizing the details he was given about why this search took place?
Not to my knowledge. Again, here's where we go back to what I said in the first half hour about rhetoric. He's wanted to frame this as basically saying to his supporters, his strong supporters, an attack on me is an attack on you, which is why they take it so personally. So he wants to frame this as purely political Whereas, again, the DOJ has evidently followed procedures. They're in place to ensure accountability and responsibility. And as many people have noted, you wouldn't think that the folks who approved this, including the judge who issued a warrant saying there's probable cause that you will find material relevant to an important investigation here, given the incendiary nature of this, they wouldn't have improvement unless they were pretty darn sure that they had good reason for needing to do this. But until they release something, and we're just not going to know, and it leaves the DOJ, so to speak, with both hands tied behind their back, Department of Justice, because the Republicans supporting former President Trump get to make all these wild charges, like somebody saying, oh, they planted evidence and all this and that. And there's not a lot they can say until the procedures allow them to say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, five minutes. Yeah, Sarah,
can
go ahead.
Add on that.
Sure.
Yeah. So in 2020, William Barr, when he was Attorney General, you know, created a new policy that if you open an investigation into presidential or vice presidential candidates, that you had to, you know, get basically consent through the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General. And as far as we know, right, Garland is still following this rule. So we have to assume then that the Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco and the FBI Director Christopher Wray were all involved in this decision. You know, beyond
Christopher Wray, appointed by President Trump.
Yes. And so I think, you know, this is not a decision that was taken lightly or without a lot of consultation among, you know, key actors in the Department of Justice and, okay. and other agencies.
Before the hour ends, we won't get them all in, but we do have a lot of input from our listeners. Let's go to Ron, and you're out of state. You're in Trenton, Missouri, Ron? No, where are you?
I'm in Trenton, Missouri. Your Lamoni station comes in when I use a good radio.
So glad to have the Missourians on board. Welcome to Iowa Public Radio, Ron. What's going on?
Before January 21, how many U.S. presidents took classified documents with them when his term ended or he resigned? Two, what are their names? Three, how many months did it take the U.S. government to get those classified documents back into secure storage? This has been almost 19 months. Thanks.
Okay. I don't know if those are rhetorical questions or if Sarah and Dennis, do you have any answers? Ron is gone, so I don't know how to interpret that. This is historically unprecedented or close to it, right, Sarah?
Yes. As far as I know, we've never had a president take this many boxes of classified materials out of the White House.
Yeah, Dennis, comment?
On leaving office.
Dennis?
I mean, like I said, the Nixon analogy was Nixon was trying to make a deal to destroy all of the relevant documents, but that was before the Presidential Records Act had been passed.
Yeah, Dennis, sorry, get in here, please.
Oh, no, that's okay. No, Donald Trump is not known as a policy person. He loves the adulation he gets from leading a movement. But is he a policy person? His idea of a good time is to sit down with a thick policy briefing book? No. So we don't know why he would have taken these, leaving people to speculate. Is there something embarrassing there? Is it something he doesn't want people to find out? But the key thing is these aren't supposedly little notes he sent to Ivanka or Melania saying, oh, by the way, I love you. They're classified documents, many of which are supposedly top secret. And the DOJ evidently had good reason to believe that their safety and security and continued existence were in danger.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's check out one more caller, Arvin in Northwood. Arvin, have to ask you to make it quick. Sure glad you're with us.
Yeah, I just want to know why they can't seem to tell the truth. Like they used to be, Bush and Reagan, they were Republican, but you could trust them.
Yeah. May I ask, Arvin, if you're declared to one party or another, or you're independent here in Iowa?
I think I'm more for the Democrats this time, because Trump just, he couldn't tell the truth if his life depended on it.
Arvin, thank you so much for calling. Yep. We're going to finish up this hour. I want to get a quick read from each of you on the primary races yesterday, revealing perhaps Trump's influence on the GOP. A Trump-endorsed construction magnate will face the governor, Tony Evers, in Wisconsin in November. Representative Ilhan Omar survived a primary challenge narrowly from a more moderate Minnesota Democrat. Other things here, a Washington Republican voted to impeach Trump over January 6th, conceded her primary, that in Washington state. Dennis, your quick read on what we saw come out yesterday.
Well, even though many of these primaries were conducted in national terms, you know, how do you feel about Trump or what do you think about January 6th and so forth, they're always intensely local in terms of who shows up to vote and why. And you have such a low percentage of people, relatively speaking, showing up to vote in primaries that any burst of enthusiasm or demoralization from one side or the other can have a tremendous impact on who actually wins.
Okay, the last word to you, Sarah Mitchell.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to remember that exactly strong partisans are the ones who are voting in primaries, so it's hard to read how that translates to the broader races. And I, you know, 538 had a really interesting analysis of how much experience the candidates that are running at various offices have, and they show that at all levels, the Democrats have a much higher experience record. And that, as we've seen in political science research, along with incumbency, translates into a much higher probability of winning. So
okay.
I think putting all these inexperienced candidates out there is risky.
Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, thank you both so much. And thanks to our listeners.
Always a pleasure.
River to River, produced today by Danny Gear. Natalie Dunlop engineered our program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.